Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
He is the author of 8 novels. His most recent is forthcoming with Princeton University Press, entitled The Lives of Animals. In 1997, Boyhood, Scenes from Provincial Life, his autobiographical novel, appeared to fabulous reviews and won the Lannan Prize. Prior to this, he won the Booker Prize for The Life and Times of Michael Kay, the Premio Mandela and Commonwealth Writers Prize, and the Irish Times International Fiction Prize for The Master of Petersburg, the James Tate Black Memorial Prize and the Geoffrey Faber Award, as well as the CNA Literary Award for Waiting for the Barbarians, and so many others. He has also written 3 provocative and lucid collections of essays, Giving Offense, Essays on Censorship, Doubling the Point, Essays and Interviews, and White Writing on the Culture of Letters in South Africa. These books have been translated into German, Hebrew, Italian, Polish, Dutch, Japanese, many languages. He is truly, truly an acclaimed writer of global status, admired above all other writers by people of all races in South Africa. I tell you all this, although I know that many in the audience are already very much aware that it is our honor to have J.M. Coetzee with us. He stands with Atul Fugard, Brayton Breytenbach, Nadine Gordimer, as South African writers who were able to find unique forms, powerful voices, ways of articulating the complex horrors of apartheid and their own moral and psychological dilemma of being white and or Afrikaans in a society motivated by a racist conspiracy to enslave the majority by the minority. It is some perversity of the human spirit that magnificent people come into being under such conditions. This has certainly been the case in South Africa, where black, white, Indian, mixed-race writers, artists, political leaders of heroic stature were formed under apartheid and found a way to make their outrage heard globally. In spite of the stultification and overt oppression of the regime, after so many years of personally attempting to speak the unspeakable, those who are still alive are now part of the collective process of reconciling truth in South Africa, which has been no small matter. In his collection of essays called White Writing, Coetzee ends his introduction with a distinction typical of the complexity and subtlety that thinking people in South Africa are always attempting to make. White writing, he says, is white only insofar as it is generated by the concerns of people no longer European, not yet African. The range of J.M. Coetzee's interests, his astute analytic skills, his willingness to face this type of philosophical and social complexity, coupled with his ability to create unique metaphor, at times allegory and fable without sentimentality, make him one of the most powerful imaginative intellects writing today. His work, essays, autobiography, and fiction, is often filled with gravity. The grace is in his ability to transform it into poetry, philosophy, and art. Like both Kafka and Beckett, with whom he is often compared, politics, history, the tyrannical behavior of desolate, barren, officious humans are never far from the surface. But he goes even further into the tragedy that humans enact on each other. Perhaps he has seen much more of it. Sometimes the text is almost too painful, the torment of the characters too great. One can barely continue the reading, and then once again one cannot stop. The conversation of the author with his audience often takes place in these deepest parts of the human psyche, where nightmares and thankfully also dreams of redemption arise. This is what has often made the work prophetic, seeing where others were not yet willing to look. And as in Greek tragedy, it is precisely Coetzee's courageousness, really, in venturing so far into the nightmare and finding there an unanticipated resolution of the human spirit that allows us as readers to awaken with him from it. As you can see, I'm a great admirer, a fan, really, of J.M. Coetzee, and delighted to introduce him to you. Thank you.
Thanks very much for those words, Carol. I had planned to read this evening solely from unpublished work, but looking over what I was going to read, it seemed to me a bit bleak. So I'll start by reading a section from Boyhood, memoir of a kind that came out a year ago, and then I'll go on to reading from unpublished work. Boyhood takes up the story of a child of 10 or so living in the town of Worcester in South Africa, which is a sort of middle-sized country town about 100 miles from Cape Town. Because there is no wolf cub pack in Worcester, he is allowed to join the Boy Scout troop, although he is only 10. For his inauguration as a scout, he prepares himself punctiliously. With his mother, he goes to the outfitters to buy the uniform, stiff olive-brown felt hat and silver hat badge, khaki shirt and shorts and stockings, leather belt with Boy Scout clasp, green shoulder tabs, green stocking flashes. He cuts a 5-foot stave from a poplar tree, peels off the bark, and spends an afternoon with a heated screwdriver burning into the white wood flesh the entire Morse and semaphore codes. He goes off to his first scout meeting with this stave slung over his shoulder with a green cord that he has himself triple braided. Taking the oath with a 2-finger salute, he is by far the most impeccably outfitted of the new boys, the so-called tenderfeet. Boy Scouts, he discovers, consists like school of passing examinations. For each examination you pass, you get a badge, which you sew onto your shirt. Examinations are taken in a preordained sequence. The first examination is in tying knots, the reef knot and the double reef, the sheep shank, the bowline. He passes it, but without distinction. It is not clear to him how one passes these Boy Scout examinations with distinction, how one excels. The second examination is for a woodsman's badge. To pass, he is required to light a fire using no paper and striking no more than 3 matches. On the bare ground at the side of the Anglican church hall, on a winter's evening with a cold wind blowing, he assembles his heap of twigs and scraps of bark, and then, with his troop leader and the scoutmaster observing, strikes his matches one by one. Each time the fire does not take, each time the wind blows out the tiny flame. The scoutmaster and troop leader turn away. They do not utter the words, "You have failed," so he is not sure that he has in fact failed. What if they're going off to confer and decide that, because of the wind, the test was unfair? He waits for them to come back. He waits for the woodsman's badge to be given to him anyhow, but nothing happens. He stands by his pile of twigs, and nothing happens. No one ever mentions it again. It is the first examination he has failed in his life. Every June vacation, the scout troop goes on a camp. Save for a week in hospital at the age of 4, he has never been away from his mother, but he is determined to go with the scouts. There is a list of things to take. One is a ground sheet. His mother does not have a ground sheet, is not even sure what a ground sheet is. Instead, she gives him an inflatable red rubber mattress. At the campsite, he discovers that all the other boys have proper khaki-colored ground sheets. His red mattress at once sets him apart. On the third day of the camp, they go swimming in the Breede River. Though at the time when they lived in Cape Town, he and his brother and his cousin used to catch the train to Fishhook and spend whole afternoons clambering on the rocks and making castles in the sand and splashing in the waves, he does not actually know how to swim. Now, as a Boy Scout, he must swim across the river and back. He hates rivers for their murkiness, for the mud that oozes between his toes, for the rusty cans and broken bottles he could step on. He prefers clean, white sea sand. But he plunges in and somehow splashes across. On the far bank, he clutches the root of a tree, finds a foothold, stands waist-deep in sullen brown water, his teeth chattering. The other boys turn and begin to swim back. He is left alone. There is nothing to do but launch himself back into the water. By midstream, he is exhausted. He gives up swimming and tries to stand, but the river is too deep. His head goes under. He tries to lift himself to swim again, but he has not the strength. He goes under a second time. He has a vision of his mother sitting on a chair with a high, straight back, reading the letter that tells of his death. His brother stands at her side, reading over the shoulder. The next he knows, he is lying on the riverbank, and his troop leader, whose name is Michael, but whom he has been too shy to speak to, is straddling him. He closes his eyes, filled with well-being. He has been saved. For weeks afterwards, he thinks of Michael, of how Michael risked his own life to plunge back into the river and rescue him. Each time, it strikes him how wonderful it is that Michael should have noticed that he was failing. Compared with Michael, who is in Standard 7 and has all except the most advanced badges and is going to be an Eagle Scout, he is negligible. It would have been quite appropriate for Michael not to have seen him go under, even not to have missed him until they got back to camp. Then all that would have been required of Michael would have been to write the letter to his mother, the cool, formal letter beginning, "We regret to inform you." From that day onward, he knows there's something special about him. He should have died, but he did not. Despite his unworthiness, he has been given a second life. He was dead, but is alive. Of what passes at the camp, he breathes not a word to his mother. The great secret of his school life, the secret he tells no one at home, is that he has become a Roman Catholic. That for all practical purposes, he is a Roman Catholic. The topic is difficult to raise at home because their family is nothing. They are, of course, South Africans, but even South Africanness is faintly embarrassing and therefore not talked about, since not everyone who lives in South Africa is a South African or not a proper South African. In religion, they are certainly nothing. Not even in his father's family, which is much safer and more ordinary than his mother's, does anyone go to church. He himself has been in a church only twice in his life, once to be baptized and once to celebrate victory in World War II. The decision to be a Roman Catholic is made on the spur of the moment. On the first morning at his new school, while the rest of the class is marched off to assembly in the school hall, he and the three other new boys are kept behind. "What is your religion?" asks the teacher of each of them. He glances right and left. What is the right answer? What religions are there to choose from? Is it like Russians and Americans? His turn comes. "What is your religion?" asks the teacher. He is sweating. He does not know what to say. "Are you a Christian or a Roman Catholic or a Jew?" she demands impatiently. "Roman Catholic," he says. When the questioning is over, he and another boy who says he is a Jew are motioned to stay behind. The two who say they are Christians go off to assembly. They wait to see what will happen to them. But nothing happens. The corridors are empty, the building is silent, there are no teachers left. They wander into the playground, where they join the ragtag of other boys left behind. It is marbles season. In the unfamiliar hush of the empty grounds, with dove calls in the air and the faint far-off sound of singing, they play marbles. Time passes. Then the bell rings for the end of assembly. The rest of the boys return from the hall, marching in files, class by class. Some appear to be in a bad mood. "Jut," An Afrikaans boy hisses at him as he passes. Jew? When they rejoin their class, no one smiles. The episode disturbs him. He hopes that the next day, he and the other new boys will be kept behind again and asked to make new choices. Then he, who has clearly made a mistake, can correct himself and be a Christian. But there is no second chance. Twice a week, the separation of sheep from goats is repeated. While Jews and Catholics are left to their own devices, the Christians go off to assembly to sing hymns and be preached to. In revenge for which, and in revenge for what the Jews did to Christ, the Afrikaans boys, big, brutal, knobbly, sometimes catch a Jew or a Catholic and punch him in the biceps, short, vicious knuckle punches, or knee him in the balls, or twist his arms behind his back till he pleads for mercy. Asseblief, the boy whimpers. Please. Jut, they hiss back. Jut, feilgoed, Jew, filth. One day during the lunch break, two Afrikaans boys corner him and drag him to the farthest corner of the rugby field. One of them is huge and fat. He pleads with them. Ek is nie 'n Jood nie, he says. I'm not a Jew. He offers to let them ride his bicycle, offers them his bicycle for the afternoon. But the more he gabbles, the more the fat boy smiles. This is evidently what he likes, the pleading, the abasement. From his shirt pocket, the fat boy produces something, something that begins to explain why he has been dragged to this quiet corner, a wriggling green caterpillar. The friend pins his arms behind his back. The fat boy pinches the hinges of his jaws till his mouth opens, then forces the caterpillar in. He spits it out, already torn, already exuding its juices. Fat boy crushes it, smears it over his lips. Jut, he says, wiping his hand clean on the grass. He chose to be a Roman Catholic that fateful morning because of Rome, because of Horatius and his two comrades, swords in their hands, crested helmets on their heads, indomitable courage in their glance, defending the bridge over the Tiber against the Etruscan hordes. Now, step by step, he discovers from the other Catholic boys what a Roman Catholic really is. A Roman Catholic has nothing to do with Rome. Roman Catholics have not even heard of Horatius. Roman Catholics go to catechism on Friday afternoons, they go to confession, they take communion. That is what Roman Catholics do. The older Catholic boys corner him and quiz him. Has he been to catechism? Has he been to confession? Has he taken communion? Catechism? Confession? Communion? He does not even know what the words mean. I used to go in Cape Town, he says evasively. Where, they say. He does not know the names of any churches in Cape Town, but nor do they. Come to catechism on Friday, they order him. When he does not come, they inform the priest that there is an apostate in Standard 3. The priest sends a message, which they relay. He must come to catechism. He suspects they have fabricated the message, but the next Friday he stays at home, lying low. The older Catholic boys begin to make it clear they do not believe his stories about being a Catholic in Cape Town. But he has gone too far now, there is no going back. If he says, I made a mistake, I'm actually a Christian, he will be disgraced. Besides, even if he has to bear the taunts of the Afrikaners and the interrogations of the real Catholics, are the two free periods a week not worth it? Free periods to walk around the empty playing fields talking to the Jews. One Saturday afternoon, when the whole of Worcester, stunned by the heat, has gone to sleep, he takes out his bicycle and cycles to Dorp Street. Usually, he gives Dorp Street a wide berth, since that is where the Catholic Church is. But today, the street is empty. There is no sound but the rustle of water in the furrows. Nonchalantly, he cycles past, pretending not to look. The church is not as big as he thought it would be. It is a low, blank building with a little statue over the portico, the Virgin, hooded, holding her baby. He reaches the bottom of the street. He would like to turn and come back for a second look, but he is afraid of stretching his luck, afraid that the priest in black will emerge and wave for him to stop. The Catholic boys nag him and make sneering remarks. The Christians persecute him, but the Jews do not judge. The Jews pretend not to notice. In a minor way, he feels comfortable with the Jews. The Jews are not so bad. Despite the menaces of the real Catholics, despite the hovering possibility that the priest will visit his parents and unmask him, he is grateful for the inspiration that made him choose Rome. He is grateful to the church that shelters him. He has no regrets, does not wish to stop being a Catholic. If being a Christian means singing hymns and listening to sermons and then coming out to torment the Jews, he has no wish to be a Christian. The fault is not his if the Catholics of Worcester are Catholic without being Roman, if they know nothing about Horatius and his comrades holding the bridge over the Tiber, about Leonidas and his Spartans holding the pass at Thermopylae, about Roland holding the pass against the Saracens. He can think of nothing more heroic than holding a pass, nothing nobler than giving up one's life to save other people who will afterwards weep over one's corpse. That is what he would like to be, a hero. That is what proper Roman Catholicism should be about. It is a summer evening, cool after the long hot day. He is in the public gardens, where he has been playing cricket with Greenberg and Goldstein. Greenberg, who is solid in class, but not good at cricket. Goldstein, who has large brown eyes, and wears sandals and is quite dashing. It is late, well past 7:30. Save for the three of them, the gardens are deserted. They have had to give up their cricket. It is too dark to see the ball. So they have wrestling fights, as if they were children again, rolling about on the grass, tickling each other, laughing and giggling. He stands up, takes a deep breath. A surge of exultation passes through him. He thinks, I have never been happier in my life. I would like to be with Greenberg and Goldstein forever. They part. It is true. He would like to live like this forever, riding his bicycle through the wide and empty streets of Worcester in the dusk of a summer's day, when all the other children have been called in and he alone is abroad like a king. So much for boyhood. I'd now like to read from some middle chapters of an as yet unpublished novel. Let me just briefly set the scene. The central character is an academic in his 50s. In South Africa, who has, as a result of an inappropriate relationship with one of his students, been asked to resign. He has left the university and has gone to live with his daughter, who lives outside a country town, running kennels for dogs and doing some market gardening. He has plenty of time on his hands and offers himself for community service. The sign outside the clinic reads Animal Welfare League, Welfare Organization 1529. Below is a line stating the daily hours, but this has been taped over. At the door is a line of waiting people, some with animals. As soon as he gets out of his car, there are children all around him, begging for money or just staring. He makes his way through the crush and through a sudden cacophony as two dogs, held back by their owners, snarl and snap at each other. The small, bare waiting room is packed. He has to step over someone's legs to get in. "Mrs. Shaw," he inquires. An old woman nods toward a doorway closed off with a plastic curtain. The woman holds a goat on a short rope. It glares nervously, eyeing the dogs, its hooves clicking on the hard floor. In the inner room, which smells pungently of urine, Bev Shaw is working at a low, steel-topped table. With a pencil light, she is peering down the throat of a young dog that looks like a cross between a ridgeback and a jackal. Kneeling on the table, a barefoot child, evidently the owner, has the dog's head clamped under his arm and is trying to hold its jaws open. A low, gurgling snarl comes from its throat, its powerful hindquarters strain. Awkwardly, he joins in the tussle, pressing the dog's hind legs together, forcing it to sit on its haunches. "Thank you," says Bev Shaw. Her face is flushed. "There's an abscess here from an impacted tooth. We have no antibiotics, so we'll just have to lance it and hope for the best." She probes inside the mouth with a lancet. The dog gives a tremendous jerk, breaks free of him, almost breaks free of the boy. He grasps it as it scrabbles to get off the table. For a moment, its eyes, full of rage and fear, glare into his. "On his side, so," says Bev Shaw. Making crooning noises, she expertly trips up the dog and turns it on its side. "The belt," she says. He passes a belt around its body and she buckles it. "So," says Bev Shaw. "Think comforting thoughts. Think strong thoughts. They can smell what you are thinking." He leans his full weight on the dog. Gingerly, one hand wrapped in an old rag, the child pries open the jaws again. The dog's eyes roll in terror. "They can smell what you are thinking. What nonsense." "They're there," he murmurs. Bev Shaw probes again with a lancet. The dog gags, goes rigid, then relaxes. "So," she says, "now we must let nature take her course." She unbuckles the belt, speaks to the child in what sounds like very halting Xhosa. The dog on its feet cowers under the table. There is a spattering of blood and saliva on the surface. Bev wipes it off. The child coaxes the dog out. "Thank you, Mr. Lurie. You have a good presence. I sense that you like animals." "Do I like animals? I eat them, so I suppose I must like them, some parts of them." Her hair is a mass of little curls. Does she make the curls herself with tongs? Unlikely. It would take hours every day. They must grow that way. He has never seen such a tessitura from close by. The veins on her ears are visible too, as a filigree of red and purple, and the veins of her nose. And then a chin that comes straight out of her chest like a pouter pigeon's. As an ensemble, remarkably unattractive. She is pondering his words, whose tone she appears to have missed. "Yes, we eat up a lot of animals in this country," she says. "It doesn't seem to do us much good. I'm not sure how we will justify to them." Then, "Shall we start on the next one?" "Justify it? When? At the great reckoning?" He would be curious to hear more, but this is not the time. The goat, a full-grown buck, can barely walk. One half of his scrotum, yellow and purple, is swollen like a balloon. The other half is a mass of caked blood and dirt. "He has been savaged by dogs," the old woman says. But he seems bright enough, cheery, combative. While Bev Shaw is examining him, he passes a short burst of pellets onto the floor. Standing at his head, gripping his horns, the woman pretends to reprove him. Bev Shaw touches the scrotum with a swab. The goat kicks. "Can you fasten his legs?" she asks, and indicates how. He straps the right hind leg to the right foreleg. The goat tries to kick again, teeters. She swabs the wound gently. The goat trembles, gives a bleat, an ugly sound, low and hoarse. As the dirt comes away, he sees that the wound is alive with white grubs waving their blind heads in the air. He shudders. Blowfly, says Bev Shaw, at least a week old. She purses her lips. You should have brought him in long ago, she says to the woman. Yes, says the woman, every night the dogs come. It is too bad. 500 rand you pay for a man like him. Bev Shaw straightens up. I don't know what we can do. I don't have the experience to try a removal. She kneels down again beside the goat, nuzzles his throat, stroking the throat upward with her own hair. The goat trembles but is still. She motions to the woman to let go of the horns. The woman obeys. The goat does not stir. She is whispering. What do you say, my friend? He hears her say. What do you say? Is it enough? The goat stands stock still as if hypnotized. Bev Shaw continues to stroke him with her head. She seems to have lapsed into a trance of her own. She collects herself and gets to her feet. I'm afraid it's too late, she says to the woman. I can't make him better. You can wait for the doctor on Thursday, or you can leave him with me. I can give him a quiet end. He will let me do that for him. Shall I? Shall I keep him here? The woman wavers, then shakes her head. She begins to tug the goat toward the door. You can have him back afterwards, says Bev Shaw. I will help him through, that's all. Though she tries to control her voice, he can hear the accents of defeat. The goat hears them too. He kicks against the strap, bucking and plunging, the obscene bulge quivering behind him. The woman drags the strap loose, casts it aside, then they are gone. What was that all about? He asks. Bev Shaw hides her face, blows her nose. It is nothing. I keep enough lethal for bad cases, but we can't force the owners. It's their animal. They like to slaughter in their own way. What a pity. Such a good old fellow. So brave and straight and confident. Lethal? The name of a drug? He would not put it past the drug companies. Sudden darkness from the waters of Lethe. Perhaps he understands more than you guess, he says. To his own surprise, he is trying to comfort her. Perhaps he has already been through it, born with foreknowledge, so to speak. This is Africa, after all. There have been goats here since the beginning of time. They don't have to be told what steel is for and fire. They know how death comes to a goat. They are born prepared. Do you think so? She says. I'm not sure. I don't think we are ready to die, any of us, not without being escorted. Things are beginning to fall into place. He has the first inkling of the task this ugly little woman has set herself. This bleak building is a place not of healing, her doctoring is too amateurish for that, but of last resort. He recalls the story of, who was it, St. Hubert, who gave refuge to a deer that clattered into his chapel, panting and distraught, fleeing the huntsman's dogs. Bev Shaw, not a veterinarian, but a priestess, full of New Age mumbo-jumbo, trying absurdly to lighten the load of Africa's suffering beasts. His daughter thought he would find her interesting, but his daughter is wrong. Interesting is not the word. He goes off to the animal welfare clinic as often as he can, offering himself for whatever jobs call for no skill, feeding, cleaning, mopping up. The animals they care for at the clinic are mainly dogs, less frequently cats. For livestock, the village appears to have its own veterinary lore, its own pharmacopoeia, its own healers. The dogs that are brought in suffer from distempers, from broken limbs, from infected bites, from mange, from neglect, benign or malign, from old age, from malnutrition, from intestinal parasites, but most of all, from their own fertility. There are simply too many of them. When people bring a dog in, they do not say straight out, "I have brought you this dog to kill," but that is what is expected, that they will dispose of it, make it disappear, dispatch it to oblivion. What is being asked for is, in fact, Lösung, German, always to hand with an appropriately blank abstraction. Sublimation, as alcohol is sublimed from water, leaving no residue, no aftertaste. So on Sunday afternoons, the clinic door is closed and locked, while he helps Bev Shaw lösen the week's superfluous canines. One at a time, he fetches them out of the cage at the back and leads or carries them into the theatre. To each, in what will be its last minutes, Bev gives her fullest attention, stroking it, talking to it, easing its passage. If, more often than not, the dogs fail to be charmed, it is because of his presence. He gives off the wrong smell. They can smell your thoughts. The smell of shame. Nevertheless, he is the one who holds the dog still as the needle finds the vein and the drug hits the heart and the legs buckle and the eyes dim. He had thought he would get used to it, but that is not what happens. The more killings he assists in, the more jittery he gets. One Sunday evening driving home, he actually has to stop at the roadside to recover himself. Tears flow down his face that he cannot stop. His hands shake. He does not understand what is happening to him. Until now, he has been more or less indifferent to animals. Although in an abstract way he disapproves of cruelty, he cannot tell whether by nature he is cruel or kind. He is simply nothing. He assumes that people from whom cruelty is demanded in the line of duty, people who work in slaughterhouses, for instance, grow carapaces over their souls. Habit hardens. It must be so in most cases, but it does not seem to be so in his. He does not seem to have the gift of hardness. His whole being is gripped by what happens in the theater. He is convinced the dogs know their time has come. Despite the silence and the painlessness of the procedure, despite the good thoughts that Bev Shaw thinks and that he tries to think, despite the airtight bags in which they tie the new-made corpses, the dogs in the yard smell what is going on inside. They flatten their ears, they droop their tails, as if they too feel the disgrace of dying. Locking their legs, they have to be pulled or pushed or carried over the threshold. On the table, some snap wildly left and right, some whine painted plaintively. None will look straight at the needle in Bev's hand, which they somehow know is going to harm them terribly. Worst are those that sniff him and try to lick his hand. He has never liked being licked, and his first impulse is to pull away. Why pretend to be a chum when in fact one is a murderer? But then he relents. Why should a creature with a shadow of death upon it feel him flinch away as if its touch were abhorrent? So he lets them lick him if they want to, just as Bev Shaw strokes and kisses them if they will let her. He is not, he hopes, a sentimentalist. He tries not to sentimentalize the animals he kills or to sentimentalize Bev Shaw. He avoids saying to her, "I don't know how you do it," in order not to have her hear her say in return, "Someone has to do it." He does not dismiss the possibility that at the deepest level, Bev Shaw may be not a liberating angel, but a devil, that beneath her show of compassion may hide a heart as leathery as a butcher's. he tries to keep an open mind. Since Bev Shaw is the one who inflicts the needle, it is he who takes charge of disposing of the remains. The morning after each killing session, he drives the loaded truck to the grounds of Settlers Hospital, to the incinerator, and there consigns the bodies in their black bags to the flames. It would be simpler to cart the bags to the incinerator immediately after the session and leave them there for the incinerator crew to dispose of. But that would mean leaving them on the dump with the rest of the weekend's scourings, with waste from the hospital wards, carrion scooped up at the roadside, malodorous refuse from the tannery, a mixture both casual and terrible. He is not prepared to inflict such dishonor upon them. So on Sunday evenings, he brings the bags to the farm in the back of the truck, parks them overnight, and on Monday mornings drives them to the hospital grounds. There, he himself loads them one at a time onto the feeder trolley, cranks the mechanism that hauls the trolley through the steel gate into the flames, pulls the lever to empty of its contents, and cranks it back, while the workmen, whose job this normally is, stand by and watch. On his first Monday, he left it to them to do the incinerating. Rigor mortis had stiffened the corpses overnight, the dead legs caught in the bars of the trolley, and when the trolley came back from its trip to the furnace, the dog would as often as not come riding back too, blackened and grinning, smelling of singed fur, its plastic covering burnt away. After a while, the workmen began to beat the bags with the backs of their shovels before loading them, to break the rigid limbs. It was then that he intervened and took over the job himself. The incinerator is anthracite-fueled, with an electric fan to suck air through the flues. He guesses that it dates from the 1950s when the hospital itself was built. It operates 6 days of the week, Monday to Saturday. On the seventh day, it rests. When the crew arrive for work, they first rake out the ashes from the previous day, then charge the fire. By 9 a.m., temperatures of 1,000 degrees Celsius are being generated in the inner chamber, hot enough to calcify bone. The fire is stoked until mid-morning. It takes all afternoon to cool down. He does not know the names of the crew, and they do not know his. To them, he is simply the man who began arriving on Mondays with the bags from animal welfare and has since then been turning up earlier and earlier. He comes, he does his work, he goes. He does not form part of the society of which the incinerator, despite the wire fence and the padlocked gates and the notice in three languages, is the hub. For the fence has long ago been cut through. The gates and the notice are simply ignored. By the time the orderlies arrive in the morning with the first bags of hospital waste, there are already numbers of women and children waiting to pick through it for syringes, pins, washable bandages, anything for which there is a market, but particularly for pills, which they sell to mooty shops or trade in the streets. There are vagrants, too, who hang around the hospital grounds by day and sleep by night against the wall of the incinerator, or perhaps even in the tunnel for the warmth. It is not a sodality he tries to join, but when he is there, they are there. And if what he brings to the dump does not interest them, that is only because the parts of a dead dog can neither be sold nor be eaten. Why has he taken on this job? To lighten the burden on Bev Shaw? For that, it would be enough to drop off the bags at the dump and drive away. For the sake of the dogs? But the dogs are dead. And what do dogs know of honor and dishonor anyway? For himself, then. For his idea of the world, a world in which men do not use shovels to beat corpses into a more convenient shape for processing. The dogs are brought to the clinic because they are unwanted, because we are too many. That is where he enters their lives. He may not be their savior, the one for whom they are not too many, but he is prepared to take care of them once they are unable, utterly unable to take care of themselves, once even Bev Shaw has washed her hands of them. A dog man, that is what he has become. A dog undertaker, a dog psychopomp, a Harijan. Curious that a man as selfish as he should be offering himself to the service of dead dogs. There must be other, more productive ways of giving oneself to the world or to an idea of the world. One could, for instance, work longer hours at the clinic. One could try to persuade the children at the dump not to fill their bodies with poisons. Even sitting down more purposefully with his work on Byron might, at a pinch, be construed as a service to mankind. But there are other people to do these things. The animal welfare thing, the social rehabilitation thing, even the Byron thing. He saves the honor of corpses because there is no one else stupid enough to do it. That is what he is becoming. The truck is loaded with his dead freight. As a last chore, he is mopping the floor of the surgery. "I'll do that," says Bev Shaw, coming in from the yard. "You'll be wanting to get back." "I'm in no hurry." "Still, you must be used to a different kind of life." "A different kind of life? I didn't know that life came in kinds." "I mean, you must find life very dull here. You must miss your own circle. You must miss having women friends." "Women friends, you say? Surely my daughter told you why I left Cape Town. Women friends didn't bring me much luck there." "Your daughter Lucy says there was a young woman who caused you a lot of trouble." "Yes, there was a young woman, but I was the troublemaker. I caused the young woman in question at least as much trouble as she caused me." "Lucy says you have had to give up your position at the university. That must have been difficult. Do you regret it?" "What nosiness. Curious how the whiff of scandal excites women. Does this plain little creature think him incapable of shocking her? Or is being shocked another of the duties she takes on, like a nun who lies down to be violated so that the quota of violation in the world will be reduced? Do I regret it? I don't know. What happened in Cape Town brought me here. I'm not unhappy here." "But at the time, did you regret it at the time?" "At the time? Do you mean in the heat of the act?" "Of course not. In the heat of the act, there are no doubts, as I'm sure you must know yourself." She blushes. A long time since he last saw a woman of middle age blush so thoroughly, to the roots of her hair. "Still, you must find Grahamstown very quiet," she murmurs, "by comparison." "I don't mind Grahamstown. At least I'm out of the way of temptation." "Out of the way of temptation. A callous thing to say to a woman, even a plain one. Yet, not plain in everyone's eyes. There must have been a time when men saw something in young Bev." He tries to imagine her 20 years younger, when the upturned face on its short neck must have seemed pert, and the freckled skin homely, healthy. On an impulse, he reaches out and runs a finger over her lips. She lowers her eyes but does not flinch. On the contrary, she responds, brushing her lips against his hand, even, it might be said, kissing it, while blushing furiously all the time. That is all that happens. That is as far as they go. Without another word, he leaves the clinic. Behind him, he hears her switching off the lights. The next afternoon, there is a call from her. "Can we meet at the clinic at 4, she says. Not a question, but an announcement made in a high, strained voice. Almost he asks, why? But then has the good sense not to. Nonetheless, he is surprised. He would bet she has not been down this road before. This must be how, in her innocence, she assumes adulteries are carried out, with the woman telephoning her pursuer, declaring herself ready. The clinic is not open on Mondays. He lets himself in, turns the key behind him in the lock. Bev Shaw is in the surgery, standing with her back to him. He folds her in his arms. She nuzzles her ear against his chin. His lips brush the tight little curls of her hair. "There are blankets," she says, "in the cabinet, on the bottom shelf." Two blankets, one pink, one gray, smuggled from her home by a woman who, in the last hour, has probably bathed and powdered and anointed herself in readiness, who has, for all he knows, been powdering and anointing herself every Sunday and storing blankets in the cabinet just in case. Who thinks, because he comes from the big city, because there is scandal attached to his name, that he makes love to many women and expects to be made love to by every woman who crosses his path. The choice is between the operating table and the floor. He spreads out the blankets on the floor, the gray blanket underneath, the pink on top. He switches off the light, leaves the room, checks that the back door is locked, waits. He hears the rustle of clothes as she undresses. Bev. Never did he dream he would sleep with a Bev. She is lying under the blanket with only her head sticking out. Even in the dimness, there is nothing charming in the sight. Slipping off his underpants, he gets in beside her, runs his hands down her body. She has no breasts to speak of, sturdy, almost waistless, like a squat little tub. She grasps his hand, passes him something, a contraceptive, all thought out beforehand, from beginning to end. Of their congress, he can at least say that he does his duty, without passion, but without distaste either, so that, in the end, Bev Shaw can feel pleased with herself. All she intended has been accomplished. He, David Lurie, has been succored as a man is succored by a woman. Her friend, Lucy Lurie, has been helped with a difficult visit. "Let me not forget this day," he tells himself, lying beside her when they are spent. "After the sweet young flesh of Melanie Isaacs, this is what I have come to. This is what I will have to get used to. This and even less than this." "It's late," says Bev Shaw. "I must be going." He pushes the blanket aside and gets up, making no effort to hide himself. Let her gaze her fill on her Romeo, he thinks, on his bowed shoulders and skinny shanks. It is indeed late. On the horizon lies the last crimson glow. The moon looms overhead. Smoke hangs in the air. Across a strip of wasteland, from the first rows of shacks, comes a hubbub of voices. At the door, Bev presses herself against him a last time, rests her head on his chest. He lets her do it, as he has let her do everything she has felt a need to do. His thoughts go to Emma Bovary, strutting before the mirror after her first big afternoon. "I have a lover, I have a lover," sings Emma to herself. Well, let poor Bev Shaw go home and do some singing too. And let him stop calling her poor Bev Shaw. If she is poor, he is bankrupt. Thank you.